again missed the beginning of it. Sorry about that.
So suppose the question is whether measuring the relation between assets and liability and measuring the relationship between liabilities and equity are giving you independent measures or just different versions of the same thing. So assets, $12 million, liabilities, $10 million. What's your equity? $2 million, obviously. So if the ratio of liabilities to assets is 5/6, what does that tell us that the ratio of equity to assets is? 1/6, right? They got to add up those two numbers. If, since we know that equity equals assets minus liability, it follows that equity divided by liability equals assets divided by liability minus liabilities divided by liabilities, and what is liabilities divided by liabilities? 1. All right, so in fact, assets over liabilities and equities over liabilities are measuring the same thing. One of them is simply the other one. Shift it over and make it that one plus one equals this one. So,
assuming I haven't made any mistakes, but basically they're really the same information. So a firm can't, as far as I can tell, look good on one of those and bad on the other. What about, consider a firm with $10 million in assets and $9 million in liabilities. What are the good things about that situation and what are the bad things? Why is that going to be different than a firm with $2 million in assets and $1 million in liabilities? Both of them have equity of $1 million. Why should you care which one you lend money to or own stock in? Why do you care? Which means, why is that an issue?
They're more.
That's right. That is, consider the situation from the standpoint of a stockholder. We say, well, they're more at risk. That means that they could go either up or down a lot. Is that a problem?
Sure.
Sensible stockholder is diversified. He's got some shares in this company, some shares in that company. So probably not a problem. How about from the standpoint of a lender?
Lender would want something more secure.
That is the problem. If you think about the gamble that company represents, if things go up and its assets go up 10%, that firm is going to double its equity, which is really wonderful for the stockholders. Doesn't do the lenders any good. All it means the lenders get paid. Suppose that it drops 20%. Now it's got negative equity of $1 million. The stockholders are wiped out, it's true, but they got compensated by the chance that it went up. The lenders get wiped out and they don't get compensated. So that you would think that highly leveraged is not necessarily a bad thing if you're a stockholder and can take risk in your portfolio, but that it's quite risky if you're a lender. Because it means the chance of going underwater becomes much higher, and you're not getting a share of the upside gamble, as it were. So you'd want to be compensated for that in the interest rate. So putting it in, what are the good things about the highly leveraged firm? Why might an investor look around the world and say, I'm looking for highly leveraged firms?
Higher upside.
If he thinks things are going to go well, he says, well, look, I mean, those piddling guys, when the industry takes off, they're only going to go up by 15%, but these guys go up by 300% because they're leveraged out the wazoo. And right? On the other hand, as I say, a lender is going to have the opposite view. Why would the degree of leveraging be different in different industries? Why might you be willing to loan to a fairly high leverage term in one industry and not willing in another? What are the sort of, in a sense, I guess, two obvious reasons in terms of what we've been saying? What are the two, putting it differently, when you observe on the accounting measures that a firm is highly leveraged, and you're concerned with their, with what the situation is going to be a year from now, what are the two different risks that you're really thinking of? Your client says, I'm thinking of lending money to or buying stock in this firm. I observe they're highly leveraged. What are the things he's going to want you to investigate? You, not necessarily a lawyer, but whoever is doing the investigation for him. That would be, yeah, I was thinking more broadly that one question is, do they really have positive equity at all, given that accounting measures are imperfect? The highly leveraged firm, if they've gotten the value of their inventory a little bit off, right, and the other question would be, how unstable over time are either their assets or their liabilities? Right? So it seems to me that those are the two issues, the two things you're worried about with your leverage. That in each case, if you knew that their account was exactly true and that nothing was going to change, there'd be no problem. Right? They got $1 million in equity, they can pay you back. But if you're afraid that things might change or afraid that the digital representation might not be very accurate, you would worry about it. So if you think about Apple's inventory of iPods, given that every tech firm in the world is trying to make the next iPod and wipe Apple out, so far they haven't managed it, you might be a little worried if that was a large part of their assets. Merrill Lynch, right now you'd be worried about their inventory of securities, but most of the time, you could say, well, we don't expect securities to go up or down for a large mixed inventory by more than 5%, maybe 10% in a year, so it's not very scary. Whereas you can easily imagine an inventory of iPods going to zero in a year. Right? And another question you might ask would be, do they have the earnings to pay their interest? How close are they to being unable to pay the interest in their debt, which is the point at which bankruptcy is likely to start coming in? Quite a different question is, how well run is the firm? You might be willing to lend money to a very badly run firm if you happen to know they had huge assets and not many liabilities. And yeah, in 30 years they will have burned up their assets and gone bankrupt, but I'm only lending for them for 3 years, so that's not a problem. All right. Might take that as the view of people who are lending to the U.S. government at the moment. They're willing to lend at low interest rates. They're pretty sure that the U.S. government is not going to declare bankruptcy next year or this year. 30 years? I wouldn't want to make any confident prediction, but presumably most of them are not doing it for 30 years. So if you want to know how well run the firm is, that's going to be important if you're a stockholder. It may be important if you're an employee. So what are the things that you might want to look at? Really, again, how do you mine the accounting figures for information that might actually be of some use to somebody? And one of the questions is, how fast do their customers pay? All right, if you think about accounts receivable versus sales revenue, you see why that ratio is what you want to think about. I was actually doing a very similar calculation in my head yesterday on an entirely different subject, but it's exactly the same logic. And this was an ad which said every 30 minutes a child is diagnosed with autism. I think it was autism. And it struck me that the trouble with an ad like that is that by putting it in terms of every 30 minutes, you have no idea whether this is really a high or a low rate, because most of us don't have a very clear idea of how frequently children are born. All right? This is putting aside the question of whether the diagnosis is true. I mean, obviously, it might be they're diagnosed with autism, but it's wrong, or it might be that only a small fraction are diagnosed. But if you just ask, what does that per 30 minute mean? And it's the kind of calculation you ought to be in the habit of doing, because people often present information to you in ways designed to create a particular effect. And so I said, well, all right, population of the U.S. is 300 million people. Suppose as a first approximation that everybody lives for exactly 75 years, steady state system. That would mean that 300 million people would mean 4 million people being born each year. 4 million people born each year. Well, there are about 400 days to the year, close enough for the kind of rough calculation I'm doing. A million divided by 100 is 10,000. So somewhere around 10,000 kids born a day. 25 hours in the day, close enough for what I'm doing. So that means that if there are 10,000 kids in a day, divide that by 25, and you've got 400 kids being born in an hour, 200 kids in a half hour. So if they're right, one kid in 200 is being diagnosed with autism. That's exactly the same calculation that's being done here, even though the context is quite different. They're saying, all right, if you are billing $1 million a year and your accounts receivable are $100,000, and if it's a steady state more or less, then that means that your average customer is taking a tenth of a year to pay you. Does that make sense? Right. You send out $1 million of bills over the year, so every tenth of a year you send out $100,000. If they take a tenth of a year to pay you, at any given instant you'll have $100,000 in accounts receivable. Is that logic of that clear? Part of it is sort of how in your head, a lot of it depends on how good your mathematical intuition is, but the question is how do you juggle between flows and stocks? All right, that some things, the accounts receivable are a stock, a given amount. Your revenue is a flow, or your billing is a flow. It's so much per year. And you say, well, all right, how much of a year's billing does that represent? That tells you how long an average time they're taking to pay. All right? So, and as the notes say, it depends on the industry as well as the management, that McDonald's accounts receivable aren't very large. All right? Because their customers pay when they get the hamburger. I don't know, are there any industries where you'd expect to have really high ratios of accounts receivable to billing? Don't know. How about the turnover ratio? So that if you say how much, if they are producing 1,000 widgets a month, how many widgets do they have in stock? If they have 10,000 widgets in stock, again, that tells you that the widgets are sitting there for about 10 months, about 1,000 a year for about 10 years. That sounds pretty dreadful before they're sold. I guess old masters might make that, but not much else. On the other hand, you could imagine a case where stuff is sold as fast as made, but the reason for that is they could have sold twice as much if only they'd had the sense to build a bigger factory and produce more. Average interest rate that the firm pays could either be evidence of doing a bad job of borrowing or of a high-risk premium. And for all of these, you'd like a comparison to other firms in the industry because each of these things is, in some sense, industry-specific. Right? There are some areas where you expect just-in-time production. There are others where you expect much longer. If I'm making custom automobiles or something, I presume, or custom houses, I suspect the turnover is very slow. How profitable is the firm? Somebody tell me what the word profit means, because it's a very confusing word because different people use it in different ways in different contexts. So, what's profit and what would you think of it as being defined in terms of? If I say this firm is doing very well, or alternatively, their prices are extortionate. Why? Because their profit is 30%. What is that 30% of?
How much they sell it for minus how much it costs them total to acquire.
That is very often, at least, the percentage that are quoted is of revenue, right? That's what you're saying. How much? So the number is revenue minus cost by some definition of cost, which itself could be tricky. But the denominator could be revenue. But of course, the other thing it could be, what it would be probably for an economist, is capital. All right. So if you have suppose we have an industry where anybody can do it. It takes very little capital investment, and you're producing $10 million worth of goods each month. You're selling $10 million worth of goods, and your costs are $9,990,000. Well, that sounds like a pretty low profit rate. On the other hand, you're raking in $120,000 a year. Sounds like a pretty good income to me. Not that one can't do better than that, but it's not terrible. I can juggle the numbers if that's too low for you. So that one way of thinking of profit is to say, all right, the profit is return on capital. so therefore 30% would be spectacularly good because you can borrow money at 5% or whatever it is. Another is its fraction of price, and then if we had a good where it took a lot of capital to build the good, the fact that you got 30% of price might, you know, maybe the capital is 100 times the amount you're selling. You don't know. And part of the question is, what do you subtract out in your cost? So, for example, if you think about the accounting definition of profit, it does or does not net out the cost of your capital, the rent on your capital. Any answers? We subtract the salaries you pay your employees. We subtract the cost of buying your raw materials. Where does the fact that in order to produce you need a factory which had to be built and which one pays interest on come into the accounting? Don't think so. That's the cost of heating the factory. What's the cost of the interest on the money you needed to build the factory? Does it? What's that going to depend on? Where do companies get their capital? There are two ways. And only one of them shows up on the accounts. A company gets capital either by issuing bonds or by issuing stock. If the company gets the capital by borrowing the money, which is what bonds are one form of, then the interest payments on that borrowing show up in the income statement as a cost. If the company got its capital because the original stockholders contributed such and such an amount of money when the stock was originally issued, then the equity now belongs to those stockholders, but an increase in that is going to show up as a profit, not as a cost. So if you imagine that the stockholders invested $1 million and that the company made $1,000 after paying all of its expenses, from an accounting standpoint, you had a profit of $1,000. From the standpoint of an investor, they just lost their shirt because that $1 million should have been bringing them in $50,000 a year instead of $1,000 a year. All right? So it's worth noting that that's sort of one of the problems with the accounting measure if you're thinking about how well the company is doing. If we have a company which was very heavily capitalized in the original investment, and we observe they're making lots of profits, that might look like they're doing very well, but it might, I mean, I've got a very simple scheme for having a very profitable company. We get the initial stockholders to kick in $100 million. We put that $100 million in T-bills. All right? We have essentially no expenses. There's one small office with an accountant who sends out dividend checks or something. $100 million in T-bills at 3%, we're getting in $3 million a year in profit. It's all profit. There's no interest payment on that on those accounts. All right. Phil?
How do you calculate profit if the company buys a trademark and uses that as future profit? For instance, like in the book they're talking about somebody buying Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
Just the brand name.
But
how do you factor that in?
If you're talking about the accounting measure of profit, then the answer is that when you bought that brand name, you spent money, you got an asset, that's a wash, didn't affect your income, you didn't affect your profits at all. Thereafter, if in order to buy it you had to borrow money, that interest is going to go on your expenses. If by getting it you increased your sales, that revenue is going to go in your revenue. All right? So, as far as the accounting is concerned, if you did it with borrowed money, then the difference between the increase in your revenue that you got as a result of having it and the increase in your costs that you got from having to pay interest on that borrowed money would be either positive or negative according to whether it was a good or a bad deal. On the other hand, if you had a bunch of cash lying around which was just sitting there as cash and you weren't collecting interest on it for some reason and you bought it with that, then you've just used up cash that could have been used to buy an interest-bearing asset from an economist standpoint, as it were. And now we have to ask, you're getting a larger return from this than you would have from that cash. All right. The real point I'm trying to make is that if you think about accounting measures of profit, there is this economically, in a certain sense, arbitrary division between the treatment of stockholders' capital and the treatment of lenders' capital. That lenders' capital, because it belongs to somebody outside the firm, the interest on that is an expense. Whereas stockholders' capital, insofar as you might pay dividends, you might not pay dividends, but the implicit interest on that never shows up as an expense. It's just the fact that your stockholders don't have some money, and hopefully they're getting reimbursed by an increase in the value of their stock. So if you're trying to decide if the company is doing well, if you observed a company which had large profits, but you then discovered that those profits were small compared to total equity, you would say it's not really well run at all, even though it's making money, because that equity, that could have just been turned into cash and used to buy T-bills. And if they're not doing better than that, then you should probably fire the president. Right? Does that make sense? Anyway, I don't remember if the book makes that distinction or not, but I'm sort of thinking about it as an economist, and it seems a very obvious point. So the going back a moment, profit in the sense which people often put it, where they're saying the supermarket pays a dollar for the box of cereal, sells it for $2, 100% profit isn't that exorbitant, but that's ignoring the fact that the supermarket has costs, that they've got to pay for their rent, their heating, their employees, their checkout ladies, and all the rest of it. And when you take all of those out, then you're going to have much less profit. And there's sort of this idea, which I keep seeing again and again, how much better off we could be if we only cut out the middleman. But it isn't true, because of course the reason the middleman is there is he's providing valuable services, and when you cut him out, you have to provide him. So if you set up a consumer co-op, now somebody other than the supermarket has to have space to store the food. They've got to have somebody who's arranging to hand out the food to the co-op members. They've got to worry about spoilage. If they have to pay for their inventory, they're going to have to borrow money or get money from somewhere in order to get that, and so forth. It's not as if there's sort of a magic trick that people will tell you this. They'll say, you know, we've cut out the middleman, so therefore you should buy from us. And, you know, the answer is, well, the way you cut out the middleman is by you're doing the same things the middleman did, and then unless there's some reason why you could do it cheaper than he did, that doesn't really reduce the cost to be the customer. So we've got profit at the first level of revenue minus direct cost. Then you've got the operating earnings, where you subtract the indirect expenses as well, and that's then available by interest, taxes, dividend, and increase equity. So you'd want to subtract out the interest first to see what your relevant profit is, and then you'd like to know your after-tax profit. You don't have to subtract out the dividends. They're one of the ways in which the profit is handed over to the owners of the firm, not a subtraction from profit. All right. The return on assets is going back to my point about the fact that if you're making lots of money, but it's a small amount compared to your total equity, then you're not doing very well. Difference between return on equity and return on assets is whether or not there are liabilities, obviously. So if the return on equity is more than the market interest rate, then they're better off keeping the firm going. If the return on equity is less, assuming equity is properly measured, which of course it never is, then they'd be better off liquidating the firm, getting their equity out, and putting it somewhere else. The obvious qualifications. Right? That some of these things are different in industries, and they all have the usual problems with the accounting as a measure. So imagine a firm whose chief asset is $1 million worth of land that's actually worth $100 million, no large liabilities, and they are renting out that land for $1 million a year. All right, well, in terms of accounting measures, making $1 million on assets of $1 million is pretty impressive. Making $1 million on equity of $1 million is pretty impressive. What should the owners of the firm do? You're a stockholder. How do you vote with regard to this firm? Sell the firm. Sell the land, right? They got an asset whose actual value is $100 million, and they're making a measly $1 million a year out of it. Now, you might also say, replace the CEO. Maybe there's a better way of doing it. We'll get our return up to what it ought to be. That's another possibility. But current arrangement is not very good. one of the places where the faults of the accounting measures may show up is in the difference between the book value of a share and the market value of a share. All right, the market value of a share represents what people are actually willing to pay for that fraction of the company, and it might be higher or lower than the book value. That if accounting were perfect, then you would expect that the share value would always be equal to just about equal to the book value of the share, but in fact it isn't for the usual reasons we've discussed. Aside from the problems with the accounting measures, it's all in a sense problems, but if you think about, aside from the obvious problems, aside from my land that's worth $100 million is on the books at $1 million, what's the obvious reason why a firm might have a share value much higher than its book value? That would be a particular example. That's in a sense the same thing as the land case in the intellectual property isn't being shown on the assets. Yeah?
Value of the goodwill.
Might be goodwill. But more generally, yeah?
The book value is going to use more historical cost that wouldn't really be a factor in determining the share value.
Suppose there's a really big difference. Suppose you happen to notice that Google, let us say, a few years back, had a share value that was 30 times its book value, which for all I know it did. Or Amazon. What would be the obvious interpretation of that?
That there are future potential profits that the market sees. But
that the market thinks that it's got a very good future. And that could be for anything. I mean, in a certain sense, that's always got to be some uncounted asset, whether it's goodwill or intellectual property or whatever. But it might be the asset might just be that they have a few clever people who have seen some new market opportunity that no one else in the world saw, and they're 6 months ahead of the rest of the world, and they're going to stay there. That would be a possible explanation. The point I was making is really just that the big deviations suggest that you believe people's estimates of future things, and those are going to be very uncertain, of course, which is why firms like Google go up and down a lot. But it's not clear that your accounting information is going to be very helpful for that. The earnings per share, that's just your net income divided by the number of shares. If we knew, suppose we were absolutely confident that the firm would be earning $1 a share from now till doomsday. Anybody want to tell me what the stock is going to be worth? In a stable world for a moment, but you have to be to earn $1 a share from now till doomsday. To make life simple, suppose that the market interest rate is 10%, which is pretty high, but makes it easy to do arithmetic. What? Why? The share, at what prices are we going to want it? If I can get a share for 10 cents that pays me $1 a year, I sure am going to want it.
Yeah.
What will the market price be of a share that pays $1 a year forever in a world where the interest rate is 10% forever? What? Would you like to sell it to me for $1? Sounds like a great deal. I pay you $1 now and you pay me $1 next year and the year after and the year after and the year after and the year after. Isn't obvious? All right. Suppose somebody said, I want to charge you $20 for this share, which will pay you $1 a year forever. What's your response? This is a world where the interest rate is 10%. So what can you do with your $20? Lend it out at 10% and get $2 a year. That's a better deal than $1 a year. Right? I'm saying the market price is going to be the inverse of the interest rate. That's right. That if it pays $1 a year, it's in the world I've described, it'll be worth exactly $10, because with $10 you can get $1 a year forever, and with $1 a year forever you could borrow $10, right? Pay the interest on it forever. There is actually such a security. It's called a British Consol. It's probably a pound a year, not $1 a year. But the British government, I think they still issue it. A security, which is simply a fixed annual payment forever. And annuities are like that, except that they usually terminate when you die, which is inconvenient. You still need the money after that, but you probably know. And suppose you observe that a company has been paying dividends or had a net income is really better, because the why is net income a better measure than dividends?
Decision of the director.
What's the obvious reason for a firm not to pay out dividends?
Well, they have a better use of the cash.
They think they can invest internally better than their stockholders can invest externally, basically, right? So if they're making lots of money but not paying dividends, then presumably the value of the firm is going up. That's just fine with you. You don't have to get your dividends. So the only worry is that in order to pay dividends, they actually got to have cash to give you, whereas they might appear to have a positive income, to have an income through sufficiently clever juggling of the books. So you might be a little worried if they didn't pay you dividends in that respect. But yeah, so suppose we have a firm which is in fact earning $10 a year. It's been doing it for the last 5 or 6 years. And again, to make the arithmetic easy, suppose 10% interest rate. If that's a stable situation, what ought the value of the shares to be? Same argument we just made. About $100, right? Suppose you observe the value of the shares is $30. Is your conclusion wonderful? I should buy lots of those. That's a great way of getting money. What other conclusion might you reach?
There's additional information.
That somebody out there has reason to think they're not going to be making either that they aren't really making $10 a year, they only say they are, or that they aren't going to keep doing it, right? So, how about the question which we've sort of been touching on and off of how you might take advantage of accounting flaws, which is useful to know not only if you're a crook, but also if you might be dealing with people who are crooks, because they might be taking advantage of accounting flaws. So you're the CEO of a company, and you want its balance sheet to look good for any of the terms I suggest there. You're trying to get a loan. You want to issue new stock. You are proposing to the board of directors that they ought to agree that in 5 years you can retire on $1 million a year, and it'll be hard to persuade them if the company doesn't look good. Or maybe you've in fact been stealing money from the company and you want to conceal that fact by making its balance sheet look good. What are the obvious legal steps to increase equity that don't involve increasing the long term? I think I may have discussed this last time, but let's go through it again because it could be useful. And steps which you might wonder if you observed a company doing this, whether that was a signal. So you're the CEO of a company, you've just taken this course, so you know what's wrong with the accounting system, so how do you make your balance sheet look better without cheating? What's the obvious way? Your company has $100 million worth of land, which is on your books at $1 million. How could you make your balance sheet look a few million dollars better? Well, selling all of them might be extreme if that's your main asset. Sell some of the land, right. That is, any time that you sell an asset whose book value is substantially less than its market value, you're going to really improve your balance sheet, right? Because you've just, when you sell it, you get cash, counts at a dollar, not at historical value of the stuff you got the cash from. All right? So that would suggest that one of the things you might want to watch for if you were trying to spot problems with a company is to say, have they in fact been selling recently assets which there's a good reason to think are worth, in fact, you could see if they're worth more than their book value because they sell an asset. There on the accounts they show $10 million at return from selling land. There on their books they show value of land has gone down by $100,000, right? That's an asset. It's an asset which was priced at $1 million for the whole parcel. They sold a tenth of the parcel. So the value of land went down by $100,000. The sales receipts were $10 million. Result is that they've got a cost of $100,000 and a revenue of $10 million, and sure enough, their equity has just shot up by just under $10 million. All right, So you see how that's something that you could actually see by looking at the accounts, and you'd then like to know why. And, you know, if the answer is there's no reason they should care about what their books look like right now, it was a good business decision for the following reasons, fine. But if what's going on is, well, I understood last year their books were looking pretty dodgy, now they're looking much solider, then you should say, all right. On the one hand, it's true that they've realized the land really was worth $10 million. On the other hand, why did they choose to sell it just now? Maybe because they're trying to make it look not only as though their assets are higher than they are, as though their income is. Because from a real sense, that it wasn't a $10 million profit, right? It was $9,900,000 accounting profit in my hypothetical case, but it wasn't any real profit because the asset was really worth that much before they sold it. And therefore, if I want to say, I, as CEO, look what a good job I've done. We made $15 million last year, so you shouldn't refuse me my million-dollar pension. That you ought to be worried about. You ought to say, aha, you did not make $15 million. You made $5 million because $10 million of it you got by simply getting something reevaluated to its real market value. All right? How about in the other direction? You want the balance sheet to look bad because you've got this plot, which I don't think is very common, but certainly is possible, where I say, I'm going to do things that won't really hurt the company, but will make it look as though the company is doing very badly, and its stock will go from $10 to 50 cents, and my buddy will then buy up half the stock of the company, and we will then release the information which makes it clear that those are only temporary setbacks, and it'll go back up to $10 or maybe $9.50 because this maneuvering is costly, and he'll pay me off, and now I can retire without persuading the board of directors to give me a pension. So, or alternatively, you want to take the company private. All right, you take the company private, you've got to pay, you've got to buy out the existing stockholders. Well, if you can make the company look really bad, you can buy them out cheap. All right. So, how would you lower the equity as measured by the accountants without actually hurting the company very much? What are any clever strategies occur to you? Don't know if I have any good ideas, but there must be some possibilities there. You people just won't make decent scam artists. I don't know how you expect to succeed in the world. But let's think about our LIFO-FIFO issue. Let's suppose you've got this big tank full of oil, and the oil was oil that you bought a long time ago when oil was when gas was up at $3 a gallon, and now gas is down to $1 a gallon, and you're using FIFO. So therefore, if you sell some of that oil, if you sell some of that $3 oil at $1 a gallon, or $3 gasoline at $1 a gallon, what's going to happen to your revenue minus cost? What's going to happen to your net income when you sell a bunch of FIFO oil when the price of oil has gone down a lot? That's right. You're losing $2 on every gallon you sell. You aren't really. You did take a loss, all right, but you took that loss when the price of oil went down and you had oil in your tank, but it didn't get it shown on the accounts then because everything is at historical cost. So that would be a way in which you could make your current year's activities look much worse than they were by doing that. And you can think of some other ways. You could say, let's recognize a cost now, or you could say, here's a very simple one. Suppose you're thinking of making an important capital investment, you're going to buy a bunch of new computers. Well, you can either expense them or you can depreciate them. If you want your profits for the year to look bad, what do? No, you expense them. If you expense them, you've got a big cost this year. Right? That makes sense? You treat them as an operating expense. So in any case, there are going to be a variety of ways. And where this is relevant, assuming none of you are planning a criminal career or even a fraudulent career, is in protecting your clients from other people by saying, this person wants my client to believe X. What would he do to generate fake evidence for X? Is he doing it? and that seems to be a useful approach for doing these things. All right? So as I say, one reason is you might want to advise your client how to do these things. The more ethically attractive reason is you might want to advise your client how not to be fooled by someone else's doing. All right, do I have this right? Yes, I do. All right, let me go back. Animal Rights League, nonprofit, Boston-based, protecting animals, and they want to switch to an accrual basis of accounting, and typically each year they get $300,000 in pledges from generous people who like animals, and they spend about $250,000 a year, and they currently have an endowment, which isn't actually going to show up in our calculations at all. They want to move to accrual, and he's got two questions. And the first question is, how do you account for the pledges? There's an annual year-end phone-a-thon. About 95% of the pledges are paid in cash within 1 or 2 months. But this is a year-end one, so they're paid in the next year. And their experience is that people who don't pay in 3 months aren't going to pay. All right. So one question is, how do you put those in the accounts? And the second question is that they've hired a new executive director. They've agreed to pay her moving expenses to move from San Francisco to Boston, and that total $150,000. She's going to earn $75,000 a year. And she is informally committed, but is not legally committed, to remain for at least 5 years. All right? So how do you account for it? So can you describe, we'll go through it in a minute, but just describe verbally the first one. How would you handle the pledges? What are the alternative ways of handling the pledges? Just give me one. One way would be to say, say accounts receivable, that's half of accounting for them. One way is that the pledges go in as $300,000 in accounts receivable. Where else are they going to go? That's an interesting question. Anybody want to persuade me that you don't count them as income at that point in the year when the pledges are made? You can argue for either side, because there are arguments for either side. What's the argument for saying that they aren't really income in that year? That doesn't mean they aren't income in that year. That's what accounts receivable is for, is a way of counting things as income before you receive the money, right?
Most states have a law where you have to contribute whatever type of money that you promised to donate, but really a donation is a gift, and strictly speaking, in contract terms, a gift is a non-enforceable promise. So with a nonprofit, seeing as how there's no exchange of goods, accounts receivable is still a kind of
The normal rule is that you want the income in the year when you do the work you're getting the income for. What's the work you're getting this $300,000 for? Because I don't think the answer to that is clear, and I think that there are two answers to that, one of which makes you put it as income in this year, and one of which makes it put it in next year. What are you going to be paid $300,000 for?
Telephone.
That's one version. You know, that interpretation, that happened this year. What's the other interpretation? Why do those people give you that money? They like being telephoned? They like animals. And what are they paying you for? And when are you going to help the animals?
Later.
What?
Later.
In the next year, right, with the money they're giving you. So it seems to me that one way of interpreting the situation is to say, this is the revenue from a telethon we did this year, and therefore goes in this year. And the other way of interpreting is to say, this is advance payment for services we're providing next year, and therefore goes next year. I don't think there's a clear reason to pick between one of them, but just they're both options. So if we look at this one, let's take a look at it. So one way of doing it, the way that you're proposing, is we have pledges receivable. Let's call that instead of accounts receivable, because it's not quite the same thing, of $300,000, and we have revenue of $300,000. Nice, simple, neat, tidy arrangement. The alternative is that we have pledge receivable of $300,000. we have a deferred income with $300,000 on the credit side, but next year on the debit side we're going to have $300,000, and then we're going to have revenues on the credit side next year of $300,000. All right, does that make sense? So the deferred income is saying that we have the pledges receivable, that's an asset, but we have, in effect, an obligation to next year to hand over that money to use to save animals next year, a $300,000 obligation, and then when it's paid, that $300,000 obligation goes to a zero obligation, and we have a $300,000 revenue in next year. So that's, all right, does that make sense to people or not? So this is one way of doing it, and this is a way of doing it if you think of it as the payment for the telephone, and this is the other way of doing it if you think of it as advance payment for the services that you're going to provide. Well, happy with that distinction? Yes, Steph?
I just don't know why you have the two revenues, that's all.
Because...
I understand you're going to balance next year's...
Because somehow I've got to get the money from this year to next year. I can't have $3,000. I can't treat $300,000 as revenue in this year, because on the interpretation we're now using, it's got to be revenue next year because it's for work is going to be done next year. So what we therefore have is that we've got an asset of $300,000. That's got to be balanced somewhere. Where is it going to be balanced? It's balanced in the fact that we have that asset and we have an obligation. What's that obligation? To hand over $300,000 to ourselves next year. That's the deferred
income. I mean, because you have two revenue accounts. I just don't see why. I mean,
well, I have one revenue account, and I have one account for something that is a liability, which is then going to be reduced. Right? We've got a liability of $300,000, which is money that... Suppose they just handed us $300,000 for a moment. But suppose they hand this to us on the last day of the year with the understanding that we'll spend it in the next year protecting animals. We would then have $300,000 in cash, but we couldn't count that as $300,000 in revenue because we haven't done the work. So we have to have some way of balancing the books that will get it to next year's revenue. So how do we do that? We say we have an asset of $300,000, we have a liability of $300,000, namely we've got to take this pile of money and hand it over to ourselves next year to be spent next year. And then next year we take that pile of money, we hand it over to ourselves next year. That means that the liability of $300,000 of deferred income vanishes. Gets balanced by a credit by a debit against that credit, and $300,000 appears in the income for next year. Does that make sense?
Okay.
I think it does. Seems to me to make sense. Next problem is what happens next year when $15,000 worth of those pledges turn out not to be worth the paper they're not working written on. All right. So how do we handle that from an accounting standpoint? Either way, we have $300,000 in pledges receivable, so I don't think that that issue is going to be relevant, right? That's a question of whether we handle it as income or whether we handle it as deferred income and then income next year. So obviously our accounts will look differently next year according to whether we've got the revenue then. But as far as what we're doing as the pledge, as what we're doing with the pledges receivable. We have next year, we have in pledges receivable, what happens to that $300,000 asset pledges receivable? $285,000 of it goes into cash, and $15,000 is written off. The $15,000 written off has to be balanced as a cost of $15,000 on our revenue T account. All right, does that make sense? So we've got $285,000 balanced by $285,000. $285,000 by which we've reduced our pledges receivable because they were paid. And that's balanced by $285,000 in cash. This is next year. and the remaining $15,000 is balanced by a $15,000 cost as we've written that off. Does that make sense? I think it works. All right. Second problem. We hired Jane Chang, obviously from California, as the new executive director. To persuade Jane to leave her previous job, we agreed and so forth and so on and so on. So the question is, how do we handle this? And all right, this one I didn't. I've been having fun with making it so that things would appear and disappear when I click them, but I guess I didn't do that for this one. So one way of doing it, the way we probably want to do it, is prepaid moving expenses are shown as an asset or a liability. What? We take $150,000 out of cash and hand it to Jane to pay her moving expenses. One thing that happens, which I'm not showing here, I don't think, is $150,000 coming out of cash. There should be an account for that too, which I haven't written. Another thing is $150,000 vanishes from cash from the right-hand side. $150,000 appears in prepaid moving expenses. Is that an asset or a liability? It's an asset, of course, right? We've paid for something which is going to be a cost over future years as we pay it off. And we paid for it in advance. We paid her the whole $150,000 instead of $30,000 a year. And then each year, what's called amortization, we, on our accounts, treat $30,000, reduce the asset, reduce the prepaid moving expenses by $30,000, and write a $30,000 expense. Does that make sense? I usually think of goodwill as being to your customers, but I don't know if you could. Let's think about it sort of a broader issue, which is one that I was raising a minute ago, which is there are various ways in which you can choose either to take an expense or perhaps a revenue now or to spread it over time. So that expensing versus depreciating is one example. But this is a different one. You could certainly imagine. What kind of a firm would you imagine? Put it differently. What features of the firm make it plausible that you would do it this way, spreading it out over 5 years, instead of just saying, to hell with it, why should we keep on putting in additional entries every year? Let's just treat $150,000 as an expense. Right? It's an expense, a one-time expense for hiring an employee. What feature of this particular firm makes it attractive not to do it that way? Suppose you were told, there's another firm. Suppose James says, you know, my friend Sally just got hired to move across the country from San Francisco to Boston too, and her firm paid her $150,000, and I looked at their account, and they just wrote it off as an expense. What do you think is the difference between the firm that hired Sally and the firm that hired Jane? If you had to guess. Might be, doesn't have to be. I bet the firm that hired Sally is a lot bigger than the nonprofit that hired Jane. All right, because if you imagine a firm where every year they hire a couple of people, they pay their moving expenses, that's a regular recurring expense, much easier to just expense it. But if you imagine a firm where, look, the whole firm, let's go back a minute, when we looked at it, this whole firm's income is $300,000 a year, and they spend half their income on this one employee. All right, that's going to look pretty bad. Now, maybe it shouldn't look pretty bad if people pay attention, but if the lump expenditure is large compared to your total revenue and expenses, then it makes a lot of sense to try to spread it out over time if you've got a legitimate reason to do that, whereas if it's small, you just say, well, each time it comes, we'll treat it as that year's expense. Seem right? I think that's right.
Is this one of the examples that you could use that if you want to show your books as being lower at year though?
Yes. That's a different reason you could do it. Absolutely. I agree. That's also possible. But I was just considering sort of not worrying about people being tricky, but just about how it makes sense to do your accounting. And the argument there is that in this case, where it's a large item and they want to be able to show their contributors that we're doing a decent job, here are our expenses, here's what you've given us, here's all the animals we've saved, spreading it out is going to make a lot of sense. All right? So, what if Jane quits after 1 year? Well, in that case, we've got an asset of $120,000, which are prepaid moving expenses, and how much does that asset now turn out to be worth? Zip. Write it off, $120,000 one-time expense, $120,000 write-off. If you're the accountant for this nonprofit and you're a little bit worried about how the donors may feel about it, what might you do to try to soften the blow? On your written out accounts, where is that $120,000 to go? Just expenses? Is that all it's going to be? They're going to look at it and they might, God, look, you every year you've been getting $300,000 and paying out $250,000, and this time you've gotten $300,000 and you paid out $370,000. You've clearly got problems. How might you want to try to reduce that effect? You put the expenses in extraordinary expenses, a non-recurring expenses, something that separates it out for the rest so that you can explain what happened. This nice young lady agreed to do a job for us and then changed her mind. So this is just a text version of what we've just been doing, where the argument is that you could debit $285,000 and the pledge is actually paid, debit cash $285,000, debit revenue $15,000. And so forth. And you could do it in either of the two ways we discussed, but one point which we haven't discussed but can raise now is that the third alternative, and the one that makes more sense for an economist but less for an accountant, is to say, look, you never received $300,000. You received $300,000 in promises, and you've got a track record, and you know what $300,000 in promises are worth. They're worth $285,000. That's what they were worth last year and the year before. In which case, you could then, in effect, treat the initial contribution not as the $300,000 in promises, but as the $285,000 you expected to get out of it, and then the only adjustment you would make for how many were paid off was if more than $285,000 were paid off, you would then get an extra bump to your income, and if less, you would have an extra cost. Right. So that would be more accurate, but it again involves the judgments which the accountants would rather not have to make. And you start by crediting cash $150,000, and if you expense it, you debit the expenses by $150,000. That's the easy way of doing it. But if you capitalize it, you now have an asset, which is the prepaid moving expenses. Each year, credit that by that year's share, debit the same to expense, which part of the expense of having an executive director is having to pay a fifth for moving expenses each of 5 years. And if you capitalize it and she quits, then you write off what's left. All right? And in all of these cases, the issue is really how you allocate your income and your expenses to what year, and in each case, it's partly a guess about the futures, all right? Whether the pledges will be honored and whether Jane is going to quit. That if you think there's a serious risk of Jane quitting, that looks like an argument for treating it as an expense in the first year, whereas if you're confident that she'll be there for 5 years, then a more accurate account is that you're really paying only a fifth of it each year. I think we're running out of time, so I'm not going to try to do this one today. So you can look at this one a little bit more and what we have for the next time, and have a nice weekend and all of that. And I am going to go home to bed. I have discovered a disturbing scientific fact, and that is that it is possible to